I was going to start off today's forum with an Iceland volcano joke, but then I decided that I should probably wait a while for the dust to settle. I want to thank our sponsors, the Penn State Bookstore and the offices of Executive Vice President and Provost and the Senior Vice President for Finance and Business. And now to introduce today's guest speaker, here's Dr. Tom Poole. He's Penn State's Vice President for Administration.
Good afternoon. I'm pleased to introduce our final speaker for this year's forum series, Penn State Professor Philip Jenkins. Dr. Jenkins is the Edwin Earl Sparks Professor of the Humanities in the College of the Liberal Arts. He joined the Penn State faculty in 1980 and studies a wide range of issues in both history and religious studies with broad interests in global Christianity, new and emerging religious movements, and 20th century American history. Dr. Jenkins is one of Penn State's most visible and well-known faculty members. He's published 24 books and at least 120 book chapters and refereed articles. His books have been translated into 12 languages. His latest, published just last month, is entitled Jesus Wars: How Four Patriarchs, Three Queens, and Two Emperors Decided What Christians Would Believe for the Next 1,500 Years. Academics love a good subtitle, and I think that's the best. Reviewers have noted that Dr. Jenkins condenses centuries of church and imperial strife with admirable clarity, and have praised the book as, and I'm quoting here, containing lots of excitement and plenty of intrigue. At Penn State, Dr. Jenkins has taught a variety of graduate and undergraduate courses in history, religious studies, criminal justice, and American studies. A highly rated teacher, he received the 2003 Penn State Alumni Teaching Fellow Award. Dr. Jenkins completed his academic degrees, including a PhD in history at the University of Cambridge. He has published articles and op-ed pieces in many media outlets, including the Wall Street Journal, the New Republic, the Atlantic Monthly, and the Boston Globe. And he is frequently interviewed on radio and television. In 2009, he became a distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion. As a leading scholar of religion, Dr. Jenkins' travel schedule for invited presentations around the world would challenge even the busiest frequent flyer. And so I am very pleased that we can have him here with us today for the Penn State Forum. His topic is the world's religious map in the year 2050. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Philip Jenkins.
Thank you very much. I'm horrified that Paddy Sotelia would make an Iceland joke. If you think about the situation, you have a country where the economy fails and suddenly the country burns down. If that isn't an insurance scam, I don't know what is. I'm going to talk about the future of religion. You might look at this and say this is an area where, you know, fools rush in. I am that fool. People have often tried to predict religion, religious futures, and the track record is frankly not great. The story is littered with disastrously wrong predictions. It was Mark Twain, for example, writing about 100 years ago, who said that by 2000 there'd be two great religious forces in the world, Roman Catholicism and Christian Science. It was Thomas Jefferson who said a lot of really dumb things in his time, writing in the 1820s, who was writing to a Unitarian minister, and said that by 1900 there would not be a man in America who would not be a Unitarian. And again, you know, way off. So why do I think that what I have to say is any more credible? And I think it is for a couple of reasons. We can argue a lot about what happens in terms of religion, but we're a lot more secure with some areas and above all, population. And I'm going to be talking a lot about population, population change, demographics, and you'll see why in a second. You know, you think about it, why do these predictions go wrong? Well, there are two main reasons. When people talk about religion, talk about the future of religion, they do one of two things. They either see what they want to see, that is, Christians think the world will be Christian in 50 years, Muslims think the world will be Muslim, and so on. Or they talk about nightmares. They talk about what they don't want to see. So if people write about Europe, for example, if they're nervous about the expansion of Islam, they will imagine the great churches and cathedrals of Europe being turned into mosques. So people draw lines, draw trends, and they come up with absurd conclusions. We're on solid ground, or more solid ground, with population. And what I want to do is just talk about some of the big population changes that are happening in this world, and you'll see why these are important. If you look at the broad span of history from about 1900, we are living through a huge change in the population of the world, where that population lives. Back in 1900, Europe had about 400 million people, and that was about a quarter of the population of the world. In 1900, there were 3 Europeans for every African. By 2050, there will be 3 Africans for every European. And if you just think of that change, that tells you right away something about what will happen in religion. There are way more Africans, to take one example, in the world. Religious patterns which prevail in Africa are going to become global trends. Let me give you a couple of examples of this. Suppose you think of the 3 countries in East Africa, of Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania. Back in 1900, those 3 countries had a combined population of maybe 7 or 8 million. By 2050, that will be 260 million. That is a big increase. If you imagine that you have 10% of a small population, and that population booms, then by definition, you've got way more of your particular religion. Okay? If you look at Nigeria, back in 1900, the lands that would become Nigeria had maybe 16 million people. Today, that's 160 million. And by 2050, it should be around 300 million. Now, can I say that those numbers are absolutely set in stone? No, I can't. Things could happen. There could be great natural disasters. A comet could strike. Any number of things could happen. But we can be reasonably confident about those population figures. What do they mean in practical terms? If you look back at the world in 1900, we've got a pretty good idea of what the main religions were, and we can see some changes. Let's look at Islam. When people are talking about the future of the world's religions, Islam is very much on their minds. They're concerned about conflicts, culture clashes. How strong is Islam now? How strong will it be? Well, the first thing is, Islam is a fast-growing religion. Please note, I did not say the fastest-growing religion in the world for this reason. Go to Wikipedia and look up the entry, the fastest-growing religion in the world, and they've got this hilarious list of about 25 claims for the current candidate. Okay? But let's just say Islam is a fast-growing religion. How fast? Back in 1900, Muslims made up about 12 or 13% of the world. Today, that's about 22%. By 2050, that should be around 27%. That's a lot more Muslims, a much bigger share of the world. Partly, that's a demographic thing. It means that where Muslims are countries where the population is growing fast. Back in 1900 again, 1/6 of Muslims lived in Africa by 2050, it'll be about one-third. If you think of Nigeria, and I think here of the distinguished guest I'm standing in for, if you think of Nigeria, for example, think about it. If they had half of the population of 16 million back in 1900, and they have half of the population of 300 million in 2050, that is a lot more Muslims in Africa. What about Christianity? Well, there's one figure that's going to be very, very easy to remember. I know I'm hitting you about the head with statistics, but bear with me. Some of them do sort of cry out for quotation. Back in 1900, Christians made up about, give or take, 34% of the population of the world. Today, that number has been revolutionized to, 34%. And by 2050, it's probably going to be 34%, correct. In other words, the raw number is not changing much and should not change much. However, if you look at where those Christians are, oh boy, it's changed. Back in 1900, something like 80% of the world's Christians lived in Europe and North America. By 2050, people like myself, that is non-Latino whites, will make up maybe 15% of the world's Christians. If you want to think of a typical Christian in the world now, never mind 2050, then think of a woman living in a village in Nigeria or a shantytown in Brazil. That's now, and that's going to be even more so. If any of you know the work of the novelist John Updike, who is not normally thought of being a great religious commentator, he has one great line I like, which is, God doesn't play too well in Sweden. God sticks pretty close to the equator. And he does, and that's going to be even more true. To give you an example, let's look at Africa again. Just, it's not the only story like this, but Christians in Africa. Back in 1900, there were about 10 million Christians in Africa, back in 1900. Today, there are about 500 million. By 2050, there are going to be, nice round number, 1 billion Christians in Africa. And they will represent over a third of all the Christians in the world. Oh, by the way, that number does not include all the Christian Africans in Europe, in the United States. By 2050, Christianity numerically is going to be predominantly a religion of Africa and the African diaspora around the world. That is a historic change. And you know, you get this if you look at all sorts of different denominations. And it's almost like pick a denomination at random. Not long ago, the president of Uganda was asked if a particular church was doing well in his country. And he sort of looked and said, it's a religion. Of course it's doing well in Uganda. Just not to take a particularly large denomination, but just to give an example, you have like the Moravian Church. There are now more Moravians in Tanzania than in the rest of the world combined. Or to think of someone else with a strong Pennsylvania connection, you look at Mennonites. Far and away, the fastest growing Mennonite church is in Ethiopia. And it grows at a rate of 15% a year, which is a normal growth rate for Africa. There was a news story not long ago about a bunch of Canadian Mennonites who were visiting Ethiopia, and the local, you know, secretary of the church was looking at last year's membership statistics, and he was saying, last year our church grew by 13%. This is amazing. And the Canadians nodded and said, yes, it's amazing. Oh, they were expecting 30%. How can I take this to the board? It's kind of a different world. Think of any denomination. I should explain, I'm in trouble at the moment for this reason. Just today, I had an article in the New Republic. And it was a great article. It was well written. It was well argued, honest. And what they then did was they gave it the most provocative, offensive title and subtitle that they possibly could. And my wife still has the email I sent her 2 hours ago, which is, this is the last you will hear from me. I am moving to Peru to hide, to herd llamas or something. We've eventually fixed it. People say, will the Roman Catholic Church survive the abuse crisis? Clearly, you know, a very big issue right now. People talk in terms of how to save the Catholic Church. Will the church survive? Whatever you think of the abuse crisis, there's absolutely no doubt that the church is going to survive, but maybe not in the places where it has done in the past or with anything like those that emphasis. Once again, let's talk about Africa. It's not the whole of the story, but it's an important part of the story. Back in 1900, there were about 2 million Catholics in Africa. By 2000, there were 130 million Catholics in Africa, which, as my colleague John Allen points out, represents a growth rate over the century of 6,700%. For those of you with a humanities background, that's more than double. And that number continues to grow. By 2025, you're probably talking about 230 million. And by 2050, it should be around 330 million. And it's around about the year 2035 that there are more Catholics in Africa than in Europe. And it's about 2060 that there should be more Catholics in Asia than in Europe. By about that point, if you rank the continents in terms of number of Catholics, Europe is fifth in place ahead of Australia. Oh, and Antarctica, excuse me. You want to think of a Catholic? Last year, there were more Catholic baptisms in the Philippines than in France, Spain, Italy, and Poland combined. And that is going to increase, that kind of tendency. The Catholic Church is going south, but not in the sense that, you know, some of its critics think. So if you look at raw numbers, you get an interesting story. By the way, there's one thing which has just been brought to my attention recently. Recently, we had George Gallup Jr. of the Gallup polls speaking at Penn State. And there's now something called the Gallup World Poll, which tries to interview people in many, many different countries around the world. And they've got this absolutely bizarre finding from Africa that we're still trying to make sense of, which is, this is the official Catholic Church's claim about the number of believers they've got in Africa. And that claim is nonsense. It's understating membership by 20%. And many of you, if you know anything about churches and their statistics, they don't underclaim. They tend not to be modest. They're being overwhelmed. Story is, they're too busy making converts to be counting them, is the short story. If you say that religious believers are going to be in a particular part of the world, that they're going to be a particular race or nation, that's an interesting factoid. But it doesn't really say anything about the behavior of those religions or what those believers are going to be like, whether you're talking about Christians or Muslims or Jews. I just want to talk a little bit about a couple of variables which affect how people follow their religion. And again, I'm going to be talking about population and demography. Please bear with me. This is not like an obsession, but it's just a useful way of looking at things. Let me just talk a little bit about the idea of fertility rates. What has this got to do with religion? Bear with me. When scholars look at population, they're interested in fertility rates. That is, the number of children that a woman will have in a particular society in her lifetime. If the fertility rate is 2.1, if a typical woman is going to be having 2.1 children, never mind. Demographers are terrible. They'll use phrases like, so Germany is ahead by half a baby. Don't fight it. A fertility rate of 2.1 means stability, okay? It means a population is going to be roughly the same. If it's way below that, then that society is going to be aging and gradually declining. So if, for instance, you have a society like Italy or Spain, where the rate is 1.2, 1.3, that's a society in trouble. It's an aging society, and in order for that society to function, somebody has to do the work. And that means immigration from Africa, from Asia, from Latin America. And that also means new religious styles. It means African, Asian, Latino religious styles, as they may be, come into Europe. By the way, there's a golden rule that demographers love in Europe. You can look at a map, and here's the rule. Easy test. The closer a woman lives to the Vatican, the fewer children she has. I don't make this up. Think about a society with lots of children. A society where a typical woman has maybe 7 or 8 children. Usually, fertility rate correlates with devotion to traditional religion. And that works both ways. Partly, if you follow traditional religion, you're more likely to follow traditional roles, and women are likely to have lots of children. But it also works the other way. If a family has 7 or 8 children, they're likely to be closely tied to religious institutions to socialize those kids, to educate those kids. Churches will be heavily involved in organizing great First Communion classes. Mosques will be organizing Quran training for kids. If you suddenly take children out of the picture, as has happened in Italy or Spain, it pushes in a big way towards secularization. Societies with high fertility rates, what does that mean? People are more religious, and over time, the religious element of the population grows substantially. Okay? I'll give you a great example of this. The State of Israel, for example. Back in the 1970s, you had these very strict Orthodox believers, the Haredim. These were people who absolutely wanted, you know, strict enforcement of Jewish law. Sometimes they'd be very militant. They would turn out and throw stones at cars of people driving on the Sabbath. Very militant, but they were like a fringe problem. Okay, by 2050, Haredim will be an absolute majority in the State of Israel. Why? Because they have a fertility rate of 7.5. A typical Haredi woman has 7.5 children. Boy, this would be disturbing if Israel was a nuclear-armed... Oh, never mind. Forget it. Birth rates are a major issue in driving religious change. There are people who believe, and I don't know what I think about this, that if you look at the United States in the last 30 years, and people talk about the growth of evangelical conservative religion, there are people who will say that's not a function of people becoming more religious, but more religious people being born, because religious families tend to be larger families. It's an important issue. But let's follow through this idea a moment. Let's assume, for the sake of argument, that societies with low birth rates, declining birth rates, tend to be more secular, less attached to institutional religion, more maybe having a highly individualized view of religion. I'm not religious. I'm spiritual. Where are the countries that have been most affected by this? Well, certainly countries like Italy and Spain. But if you want to see the fastest decline of population growth rates anywhere in history, you know where you see it? The Muslim world. And the country that has had the sharpest decline in fertility rates is, think of somewhere, a calm, stable country, Iran. Back in the mid-1980s, Iran had a fertility rate of over six children per woman. That is now down to 1.5 the last time I looked, and heading rapidly for 1.2. Now think about that. Yes, you have that kind of big population cohort working through, like a baby boom. But in a few years, it is very probable that Iran, on that evidence, is going to be one of the most secular countries, never mind in the Middle East, in the world. You know, I have this vision in 2020 or 2025, you know, some Ayatollah will say, let us declare a jihad. And a bunch of 40-year-old guys will say, nah, we're busy playing video games. If you want to understand the Muslim world in the future, do not look at raw numbers. Do not look at X percent, X million, X hundred million. Think of it in terms of the type of Islam. Exactly the same as in the type of Christianity. Don't forget, Islam historically is as diverse as Christianity. Okay? Islam is rapidly hitting a two-tier system where you have countries that are like Iran with low fertility. Why? Because in a country like Algeria, for example, women make up 60% of doctors, 60% of lawyers, 60% of university students. They're not going off to have seven kids. They're much less open to traditional or often intolerant forms of religion. They want more choice. The Islamic world is pursuing a, if you like, a fork. There are two sorts of countries. There are the ones with very high birth rates, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and the absolute highest in the world, what you might call the sort of the tourist nightmare list. What are the highest fertility rates in the world? Somalia, Yemen, Iraq, Afghanistan. These are still extraordinarily high. But if you look at many Islamic countries, they now look like Iran, or they're getting there. Tunisia, Morocco, Algeria. Everything points to them being very secular European countries. You want to look at the idea of conflict. Can Christians and Muslims coexist? Well, it depends what sort of Christians, what sort of Muslims. For instance, people have nightmares about Europe. They look at Muslim immigration into Europe, and they imagine this as a kind of barbarian invasion, and they think that Europe is going to be swept away into some kind of Eurabia, which is a phrase that people use. Well, a couple of things. First of all, look at the numbers. If you've read news stories from the last few years, you might think that Muslims swamp Europe. The actual proportion of Muslims in European countries is round about, anybody care to guess, about 4.5%. If I went to a city in the United States and I said, so what's the ethnic balance here? And someone said, well, we're about 4.5% minority. I'd say, oh, it's all white. So, it's a matter of proportion. But immigrants in Europe, two things. First of all, a lot of them are Christian, which we tend to forget. But also the Muslim and the Christian immigrants have plummeting birth rates. Why? The most important thing in understanding religious change is women and how women define their lives and their life opportunities. If women see themselves, define themselves in terms of career and education, then that is going to correlate with lower fertility rates and probably lower adherence to fanatical religion. This is like, by the way, but you know, people talk about causes of terrorism. And you imagine all these young men all over Europe, and often they have these kind of cultures where in the West, kids might watch violent video games, and you have all these kids who are watching real beheadings. And they're watching these absolutely frightening jihadi websites. Why are they doing it? In most cases, because the boys in these societies have failed, and their sisters are out at universities and good jobs. If you want to understand terrorism in Europe, look at it as a gender and family thing. Look at it as revenge against uppity women. Very, very important topic. So, you know, if somebody said, what will Europe be like in 2050? Will it be Muslim? I think it'll be a really quite a secular society. It's not that Europe is becoming Islamized. It's that Europe and the Middle East are joining one sort of culture. You know, in wherever you go in Europe, you see these satellite dishes, okay? And in immigrant areas, they're all pointing to Arab and Muslim stations like Al Jazeera. But you also have satellite dishes all along the North African coast, and they're looking at American and European cable channels, and they're being influenced by them. And the local Muslim clergy hate that. And when they see those discs, they have a name for them. The French name for these discs is parabolique. And what the clergy call them is paradiabolique. The devil's weapon to make women behave in these terrible ways. And maybe they're right. And maybe they're the ones who've actually figured out what the situation is. I started off with this basic question of the world's religious map. And, you know, it's an important question. Because don't forget, no religion comes with a warranty. Religions die. We tend to think that, you know, you look at religions around the world today, those are the ones that have always been there, those are the ones that will always be there. It's not true. Religions can die altogether, they can die in particular areas. 1,000 years ago, there was a religion called Manichaeanism, which stretched from France to China. Have you met any Manichaeans recently? If you have, refer them to me immediately. Religions can die in particular areas. I always think the greatest quote I know about, I suppose, the geography of religion is actually from a Catholic saint writing back in the year 1640. He said something very clever. 1640 was the worst year in European history before 1940. Protestants were killing Catholics. Catholics were killing Protestants. Christians were killing Jews. And there was a man called St. Vincent de Paul, and he looked at this and said something interesting. Jesus said St. Vincent, Jesus said, his church would last till the end of time. He never mentioned the word Europe. The church of the future, he said in 1640, will be the church of South America, of Africa, of China, and Japan. We'll quibble about Japan, but otherwise that is a very accurate statement. Religion will continue to flourish, will continue to matter, but maybe not in the areas where you think of it as. If you want to look at the future of religion, again, think of, you know, Updike's rule about moving to where population goes, the idea that God goes where he's wanted. And often that means Africa, South and East Asia. But largely the denominations that we see today are probably going to be the ones that are going to be around in the future. And if I had to say what the largest single religious organization will be on the planet in 2050, it'll probably be the same one that we know today, which is the Roman Catholic Church. Now, the Catholic Church has a big problem, which is that the Vatican is 2,000 miles too far north, and they need to relocate it. But if I can just quote one phrase here, which I sort of like. This is written in 1850, and I sort of like it. This is from Lord Macaulay talking about the future of the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church was great and respected before the Saxon had set foot in Britain, before the Frank had passed the Rhine, when Greek eloquence still flourished at Antioch, when idols were still worshipped in the Temple of Mecca. And she may still exist in undiminished vigor when some traveler from New Zealand shall, in the midst of a vast solitude, take his stand on a broken arch of London Bridge to sketch the ruins of St. Paul's. London will die, Britain will die, but the religious organizations tend to go on. And as we've discovered in the last few years, figuring out which ones and where is at least as important as knowing where those oil wells are. And if I may, I will wind up there and throw that open to your questions.
And we need another day. There are so many questions here. I'll begin with a 2012 question. Do you believe we will even see 2050? Do you think we are in the last days?
When you say we, do you mean me personally, or? You know, it's an interesting question. I was born in 1952, which means I'm 37 presently. But when I was growing up, you know, in the 60s and 70s, I was absolutely convinced we were never going to see the year 2000 because of nuclear war. And I thought there was no way we were going to avoid that. So I'm, you know, I see no particular reason why, you know, why we should vanish by 2050. Of course, there are, you know, supposedly Mayan prophecies that have us all ending in 2012, but I wouldn't worry too much about those.
How did you first get interested in religion as a field of study?
That's an awful question. I don't know. Normally, let me just adapt that slightly. How did I get interested in global religion? And that's the same answer as with most of my books. I was arguing with an article in the New York Times. And the New York Times was predicting what the future of religion would be. And being the New York Times, it's imagined that in future there might be a Christendom like in the Middle Ages. And being the New York Times, this would be environmentalism with a New Age twist. And I looked at it and said, no, I think the Christendom of the future might be old Christendom or Islam. And so that was a few years before 2001. I've been publishing a lot since then. My book, The Next Christendom, was a very well-timed book. It went to press on a date many of you will remember, September the 10th, 2001. There's a scholar called Peter Berger who has a wonderful quote, which is, he says, let me get this right, Indians are the most religious people in the world. Swedes are the least religious people in the world, and the United States is a nation of Indians governed by Swedes. And I always add a clause there, which is, and the New York Times is the newsletter from the Swedish embassy.
Now, two people wanted to know, what, if any, spiritual religion do you identify with and why?
The Episcopal Church. And I have my spiritual advisor here to answer that that question. I suppose I belong to a small C Catholic tradition in which the Anglican and Catholic is one version. I always like the remark that these days the Anglican Church has about 2 million members in the United States and 80 million worldwide, and it's overwhelmingly an African church. By 2050, it'll be 150 million, and there'll be mainly African, so I'm very pleased to belong to a global small C Catholic church.
Four people wanted to know about Asia.
Okay, sure.
I may ask variations of several. What impact will the Asian continent have on religious growth and change, especially in China?
Huge question, very interesting. China is one of the real mysteries on the map. The Chinese government says there are about 25 million Christians in China, so you know there's more than 25 million. There are many experts in this country, including, and the State Department accepts these figures, that says that there are around 110 million. I'm fairly conservative and accept about 50 to 60 million, which is a sort of a small figure. On the other hand, if you accept that figure, that still means that there are more Christians in China than in pretty much any European country. The odds are that Christianity will grow rapidly in China. I don't think it's going to create a kind of Christian hegemony, as some people predict. But that's very important, and it has a lot of impact among Chinese intellectuals and opinion leaders. I always look at one man called De Bei Kun, who's like a filmmaker and a novelist, and he's sort of a kind of Quentin Tarantino character. His stuff is all very violent. And about 15 years ago, he amazed people by converting to evangelical Christianity. And he does all these stunning books and stories now. So, China, it's a great presence. The other fascinating country is India, where you probably have 40 million Christians, some of them in ancient communities going back to the first century, but many others just as a result of recent conversions and facing a very, very difficult legal environment and often quite forceful persecution. Please understand, when I was talking so much about Africa today, I was just focusing on one side of things and, could easily have done the whole thing about Asia as well. Certainly wasn't trying to exclude that.
Four questions here on terrorism, so I'll try to cover some of them. Across the globe, some of the most terrorizing acts are undertaken by highly educated individuals, men. Do you subscribe to this view? So a lot of questions here about this link between education and radical Islam.
Yeah. There's a book that came out a few years ago about female terrorism, about women as terrorists. And it's the title of the book is a phrase that they use in various anti-terrorist forces, which is shoot the women first. And the idea is that women terrorists are likely to be the more dangerous and the more ready to kill. It's very hard to base that. When I was talking about men, I was particularly talking about men in Europe living in a society of very rapid change all around them, trying to figure out how they belong in that society, which the girls have figured out. Their sisters have figured that out. And it's the men who are feeling left behind. By definition, they're not so much feeling left behind in a country like, Chechnya or whatever. I would be nervous answering that as a generic way because there are so many examples of, say, women as terrorists, women as suicide bombers. The most recent attack in Russia was of course by a woman who was the widow of another terrorist. I just want to kind of underline one thing there. I always worry with questions about terrorism, and this is certainly not a comment about any questioners here, when we look at it entirely in the form of one word, terrorism and Islam. Because one point we tend to forget, virtually everything that's done today by Islamic terrorism in Europe back in the 1960s and 70s was done by Middle Eastern terrorists in Europe who were largely not Muslim. I mean, back in the 1970s, some of you may be old enough to remember this, there used to be all these hijackings in Europe, okay, and they'd hijack aircraft. Those planes, the teams hijacking those planes had an Orthodox Christian chaplain to bless their mission. These are very weird Islamic fundamentalists. In fact, they're what we call Catholics. Okay? They were Arab Christians. So. Yeah, sorry.
Speaking of women and terrorism, you speak of terrorism as a result of, quote, uppity women. Does that mean that if all women stay home and raise many children, there will be no terrorism?
Yes.
Move on.
Or if I can elaborate on that. No. What I said was a male perception of uppity women, which is a totally different thing. Thank you. And I was specifically talking about Europe. But you know, if you look at countries where there is intense Christian-Muslim conflict, just to take one example, there are lots of other forms of religious conflict, then often gender and family issues are central. And if you look in Nigeria, say, in areas like central Nigeria, we've had 10 or 12,000 people killed in the last decade in struggles. If you ask Muslims why they're so angry, one of the main concerns is, we don't want our women living like those you see in Western media. And in other words, the sense that our women might become like that is the ultimate nightmare. And the sense of the family being subverted, women going out and becoming broadcasters, interviewers, people like that, it's a terrible idea.
Scandalous people like that. Your book, Pedophile Priests, and that may not be the exact title, posited the idea that Catholic priests are no more inclined to sexually abuse children than ministers in other denominations, rather that the Catholic Church has deeper file cabinets and deeper pockets. Has your view of that changed in recent months?
That's your question, isn't it?
It is my question.
I know it's your question. When you're finished being uppity, I'll answer that. What I actually said in the book was it's very much on the issue of evidence. And what I actually said was no more or no less. And what I said was than clergy of other denominations or of other secular professions dealing with children. And for example, if you ever want to see something which may surprise you in the light of the recent abuse crisis, look at a report from the US Department of Education by a woman called Carol Shakeshaft, who looks at reports of sexual abuse by public school teachers. And she finds a rate of known and reported abuse which is far higher than that anyone's ever suggested for Catholic priests. And you think, well, how can that be? Well, you know, a whole lot of it depends on how the stories get reported, how they get contextualized in the media. And the other thing is the vast majority of Catholic cases, we hear a lot about them, very simple reason, most of them are from the 1970s, and most of them surface through civil litigation, which works in a completely different way from the criminal justice system. Very, very few of the priests who actually do end up in trouble could be convicted, because they've been proven guilty on a level of 51% proof, not 99% proof. It's a long, it's a long story. Do I still believe it? Yep.
What are the rates of people that change religions in their life, and what will that mean when we look at 2050?
Boy. There's a lot of evidence from the United States and Europe about very, very extensive changes of religion, of denominations. In fact, there's an oddity about the United States. The second largest religion, if you think about it this way, is ex-Catholics. I don't make this up. And the other great issue, of course, is mixed marriages and you know which church people or religious grouping people end up in as a result of that. This is so important because in other parts of the world, the issue of conversion is one of the most sensitive factors driving violence and conflict and terrorism. In let's talk about Nigeria, because originally this was meant to be a presentation by former leader of Nigeria. One of the biggest things driving riots is the sense that if you're a Muslim, your son or your daughter might go off and become a Christian. And so anything involved in religious proselytizing, evangelism, conversion, is a deadly fear. In fact, you could write a book about one thing. I don't know how many of you have ever seen something called the Jesus video. I don't know how many of you are familiar with that. Back in the 1970s, there's a film called Jesus, which is made by a British company. And you watch it and you think, oh, that's okay as a film. It's since been made into, I believe, 400 million copies worldwide. And it's been distributed in every corner of the world as a tool of evangelism. People will hike these things up to villages in the Himalayas, you know, and set up slideshows. They'll use them to try and convert people. It's one of the most effective weapons of mass instruction in the world. But in a country like Nigeria, it's devastating because it's so effective for Christians converting Muslims and then creating violence as a response. So if everyone just stayed in the same religion, we'd probably all be happy. But we don't. And that's a large force driving religious conflict.
Well, speaking of Nigeria, and I was thinking that I was going to get out of this without having to say the name. I understand that
Mr. Obasanjo.
Oh, thank you. Is a born-again Christian.
Yep, very much
Do you
so.
Know of other African leaders who are, and what kind of influence are they having in their countries?
Yeah. A great many of them are. Uganda is one of the most important countries in that way. But one of the big events in Africa in the recent years is people trying to declare their countries Christian countries, Christian states. And the great example was a few years ago in Zambia. They had a president called Frederick Chiluba who said, tried to declare Zambia a Christian state. And the general response among Christians was, what a stupid idea. Of course we're a Christian state. Why do you have to say it? But there is a fear that in years to come, in response to Muslim states declaring Sharia law, you'll get more and more Christian countries declaring themselves Christian states, and that kind of makes things more more polarized. Uganda is kind of interesting because that then gets into issues of how you react to AIDS, which of course is a pressing danger across much of Africa. But you cannot understand African politics, black African politics, without understanding religion, particularly Christianity. And the other area where that's actually very true now is in Latin America, areas where Protestantism and Pentecostalism have grown very fast. And you have these very active Protestant Pentecostal leaders. The first couple were really awful. But we can have hope for the future.
There are sometimes huge differences between members and denominations in different countries. For example, South Korean Presbyterians compared with American Presbyterians.
Yep.
What impact do you see happening because of this?
Okay. A couple of things. If religions change just in terms of different color, different race, different ethnicity, that's one thing. But what happens is, in a globalized world, is you have lots of different sections of churches with very different ideas. And where we've seen this very forcibly, you probably heard, for instance, about what happened in the Global Anglican Communion, where the Episcopal Church in the US is very liberal, appoints openly gay bishops. And African Anglicans and Asian Anglicans think this is a terrible idea. And so you get a lot of global conflict in that way. It's quite possible that many denominations will split over that. And who knows, maybe in 2050, there'll be two sorts of church in the world. There'll be kind of more conservative global south ones in Africa and Asia and Latin America, none of which actually recognizes what happens in Europe as Christian. And that's possible. But all denominations have to be aware of this for this reason. We're not just talking about a world divided between North and South. The North is in the South in the form of media and money and soft power. The South is in the North in the form of people. By 2050, 25% of Americans will have Latino roots, 8% will have Asian roots, both mainly Christian. You add another 15% or so African or African-American, and the United States is heading for what we call a majority-minority country. Any church in the United States needs to have those figures up on their notice boards in big letters, because all these issues of different culture, different geography, different attitudes are going to be front and center in all denominations. Just give you one example very quick. There's a small church, respectable Protestant church called the Seventh-day Adventists. Back in 1957, they declared that they had 1 million members. Today, they have 16 million members. Back in 1957, they had 1 million in the United States. They still have 1 million in the United States. The other 15 million are elsewhere. The 1 million in the United States, maybe between a third and a half of those are old stock whites. The rest are Latinos, Asians, Haitians. And on a day-to-day basis, they have to figure out how they're going to deal with these sort of issues. They're there now. Most denominations are going to be there very, very soon. And incidentally, can I add one thing? That's also an issue for Muslims, in the sense of you have maybe a traditional Arab or South Asian Muslim community, and they have to deal with all these Africans. But is that really Islam? All these culture issues are going to be front and center in 2050. They are now.
If we can answer these quickly, we can probably get two in. So right. I'll give it a whirl. How about the apparent growth of atheists or agnostics, and what are your predictions?
Yeah. I still tend to see that as a fairly small phenomenon. If you look at the whole span of American history, atheist and agnostic influence today is far, far smaller than it was in, say, before the Civil War. I mean, you could easily be elected in America to public office in 1850 as being publicly atheist and militantly anti-Christian. It's very hard today. So I tend not to pay too much attention to that, but you know, maybe time will prove me wrong.
I'm going to ask this final question here and then join you at the podium.
Sure.
Can you speak to trends in religious spiritual affiliation among college students, the time when many young adults explore other beliefs?
You know, I'm not going to try and address that. That's really outside areas I'm really comfortable with. So if I may, I will chicken out on that one, particularly because since I know there are at least about a dozen people in the room who know more than me and are starting to glare at me already.
Then I'll give you 30 seconds to answer the question about Hinduism and Hindus. Where do you see them in 2050?
Okay. You know, it's interesting. If you look at the statistics, it's one of these where in 1900, Hindus made up about 12% of the world's population. Today, they make up about 12% of the world's population. And reasonable bet in 2050. So in other words, a huge tradition, a very large tradition numerically, very important intellectually, but one that its main growth is, of course, through the Indian diaspora. And those tens of millions of Indians and Hindus worldwide. The place I always enjoy here is when you drive into Pittsburgh through Monroeville, you see these magnificent Hindu temples, and you think, why are they there? Why do you have these survivals of ancient South Asian religion? Very simple, because of all the engineers and scientists at Westinghouse. And so you have these very high-tech people, and what's the first thing they did? Built a Hindu temple.
Okay,
wonderful places.
I'm going to join you at the podium for our last question.
Okay.
But before we ask that last question, I'd like everyone here to give a hearty thank you to St. Philip Jenkins for saving the day. We don't have wings or a halo, but we would like you to go away with our official Forum plaque and mug. And thank you so much for, as I said, saving the day today.
Thank you very much, Bobby.
Don't go just yet, though.
Don't go away.
We do have one last question. As an expert on religion, you've undoubtedly run across some of the more offbeat theologies, and I'm wondering if you can talk about some of them. For instance, George Carlin once claimed to be a Frisbeterian. Mm-hmm. He believes that when you die, your soul goes up on the roof and gets stuck.
Well, the only example I would choose is one you can check out easily online. And it's the Church of Elvis Presbyterian. And as the phrase goes, I don't make this up. And it's got a whole series of analogies between Elvis and Jesus. One was the king, one was the king of kings. And I believe they have an unusual sacrament consisting of cheeseburgers. And that's all I really want to say.
Thanks so much. Thank you, everyone. Have a great afternoon, and we hope to see you here next season.